Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Radio 930 WBEN. It's Tom Bowerly and David Bellavia. It's Bowerly and Bellavia on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Talking about the SATs, and that, of course, is one of the criteria upon which students are admitted or not admitted into college. And the SAT, at the lead and instigation, I guess, of the same people behind College Core, behind Common Core, they are adding an adversity score anywhere from 1 to 100 for students who come from particularly bad backgrounds and bad neighborhoods with high crime rates, et cetera. And we're getting your take on that at News Radio 930 WBEN. Is this something that is fair, or is this something that is typical left-wing BS? Let's go back to the calls people have been holding. Here is Steve in Niagara on WBEN. Steve, you are on Bowerly and Bellavia.
Hello, gentlemen. You know, some of the greatest contributors to society have been people who have greatly overcome adversity. And, you know, I just think it's a crock. I think it's a shame. If anything, too, I mean, giving them better opportunities to get to college, sometimes with our education system right now, they're probably going to end up more messed up. I mean, we have very educated people running this country, and, you know, we know how that goes. So, I mean, I think if you give people an opportunity to overcome adversity, I mean, when you look back to from Abraham Lincoln to George Washington Carver to modern day Dr. Ben Carson, these people have overcome great adversity, and that just builds character. And I think strong character people are, you know, are much more of a contributor to society.
So the score, what do you think the ramification is going to be of the adversity score looking down the line, sir?
If anything, it's just going to make things, I mean, totally unfair. I mean, that's a really bad criteria to try to institute. And just like David was saying, I mean, how do you judge that? How can you possibly judge that? And who is going to be judging that? It's, you know, people should always just be graded on their merit. I mean, not, you know, any kind of gimme scores, which is what I think that is.
All right, Steve, thank you very much for the call. We go to Ricky in West Seneca. Ricky, whatever you do, call again. Don't lose that number. Ricky, you're on WBEN.
Hi, gents. Happy Friday. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So I found this to be a case of history repeating itself. If we go through the timeline, you guys already mentioned the adding of the Common Core. Then for the 2010-11 high school year, a lot of changes happened. One of the first things was for mathematics in general academia, they went from teaching all of math properties to just algebra with the students. And then that same year also was the first class who, if you wanted to go to an Ivy League school, you went from having to apply with their specific parameters to then having the opportunity to get into the Ivy Leaguers through the Common App. And then, of course, the year later, you had the quote from Obama somewhere around the time of his reelection that you didn't build your success, someone else did. And so now this adversity score, which I would guess for me in high school would have been a 275, is probably ramped up more now, of course, with more adult things in my life. But
well, it only, yeah, I was going to say, it only goes from 1 to 100.
Yeah, so, but if you, so what are we saying? That 27 and a half then for me. But we come to this point where, you know, we've seen it both ways, and we've also seen it where it keeps happening in new ways, but over and over again at the same time.
So what do we do to put an end to this? If it's wrong, I mean, isn't it just going to get worse?
One would think that it's going to get worse. My concern is, though, if we have this happening, well, a few weeks ago, weren't we just talking about the, you know, when in the advent of the college loan scandal recently, you know, what happens to all these people that we're trying to afford these opportunities to by having stuff like this implemented? Well, then, if the proposal by Senator Warren happens that, you know, college tuition for certain folks are going to be free, that just adds fuel to the fire. So if we find a solution, there's just going to be something else that pops up is what my concern is.
So the next thing, this is a great point, the next thing is going to be the higher your adversity score, the more likely it is your education may be free or offered at a greatly reduced rate.
I mean, that's how I see it going. The only other thing that I'm concerned with is we see people that are getting various scholarships, academic, athletic, otherwise, and the athletic thing is a mess of its own. But, you know, we take all of these opportunities for everybody, not just folks who are well-privileged or underprivileged, but those people in the middle too. But how do we then decide at what proportionality is appropriate? Is there an appropriate proportionality for it? You know, there's a lot of analytics that need to go behind this and a lot of further studies to make sure that whatever we put in place is done appropriately.
All right, fair enough. Thanks very much.
Always. Thank you, guys.
There's Ricky in West Seneca. Let's go to Daniel in Amherst, 803-0930, star 930, 1-800-616-WBEN. Should SAT scores take into account the adverse circumstances from which a student may come? And Daniel Amherst, you're on WBEN.
No, Tom, I really don't think that they should. And my biggest concern is, you know, I get it, people have adversity, but I see this being abused. You know, most recent in the news, we saw the whole college admission scam where people were trying to find that extra edge to get their kids into college. And if they're looking at neighborhoods there, what's to prevent me, if I have an extra $100,000 to go in a poor neighborhood, buy a house in the Fruit Belt and say, hey, this is our home, here's our adversity. You know, an extra 100 points could put that kid in a better school.
That's an excellent point. Like, you could start getting a bunch of rich people to buy, you know, apartments in the worst sections of town. I mean, listen, they spent $500,000 to get into Stanford and USC.
All right.
Heck, sign me up. I'm going to sell adversity.
Sell? Okay,
that's
what
you're
going to
do.
The adversity rental business, the adversity sales business.
You know, you give me 32 weeks, and I will slap you across the face every morning, noon, and night.
Absolutely.
Belittle you and feed you bowls of steam. It's all about your future. That's what we have to plan for. It's like an adversity boot camp.
What a great business plan. I like the model there, Daniel.
Yeah, the adversity part, you know, I really don't buy. You know, I had adversity. I got married young. I got five kids. I have a great job. I went to college. I did it all myself. I've been on my own since I was 16 years old. You know, I have adversity. Nobody paid for my way to go through college. And I come from one of the most failed New York City experiments with the Regents. When they decided it's the failed Math A, Math B, they switched everything. Then it went to Common Core. They don't know what they're doing. And I just really see this whole thing, giving people an edge that really don't deserve that edge or need that edge, and B, it being abused.
You know, I wonder if Tarzan would get into, you know, Harvard. He was raised by, you know, you could make the argument.
I don't think his verbal score would be real high in the SAT.
That's right.
Me, Tarzan, you, Jane, and might not make it.
But the adversity thing, I mean, when you're raised by animals, you know, that'd be...
All you got to do is write a one-state protest statement on a piece of paper nowadays when you get into Harvard. So, you know, just ugh. You know, I'm sure it'll get you in.
Ugh.
Make sure you wear your vagina hat to the interview.
Absolutely. Or have your mom with you, you know?
Oh, yeah. We talked about that the other day.
Well, I worked in human resources for years, and, you know, it's pathetic. David was talking about adversity in the workplace. You know, we, unfortunately, today, you're forced to take into account of adversity. You know, part of my job was to work with different community groups that work with these different types of people. And unfortunately, you sometimes have to, with the economic state that we're in New York, when they tell me, hey, if you hire these felons that we're going to vouch for, or somebody that's poor, we're going to pay you training wages. So while they're in training for like 3 or 4 months, we're going to pay their full wages. You don't even have to keep them. They just want them in the training. And that's, you know, part of the adversity is just cycling these people through a system where they're not going to succeed. They're not going to make it on their own. I mean, sure, they're getting these hard skills that, you know, they can have, but nobody's teaching them how to be people and how to get these soft skills.
Or how about the idea of teaching critical thinking? Because that seems to be sorely lacking among many adults and many younger people today.
We're, you know, my generation, unfortunately, and beyond, it's a failed experiment. And I feel horrible to see it, but there's many that are going to be lost, and it's going to be this way for a long time.
Well, they've turned people into sheep, I'll say that much, to a great extent. Sorry, I didn't mean to excite the country boys listening. Sorry about that. You've heard that sound before.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm a big fan of the show. David, thank you very much for your service.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. We are at 803-0930, *930, 1-800-616-WBEN. And I'm sorry, I'm just thinking about a Photoshop picture. Anyway, it is Powerly and Bellavia on News Radio 930 WBEN. And we're talking about whether or not the SAT should include a student's adverse background, you know, all kinds of tragedy, high crime rates, et cetera, when submitting the application package to the college or university of their choice. So should colleges and universities consider the adversity score the SAT is going to include as part of the college admissions package for a student? Now, they claim that the score is going to go between 1 and 100 in terms of levels of adversity. I mean, you would have to be, again, raised by wolves and living like Tarzan in order to get a 100 adversity score on the SAT. But supposedly, it's not going to be added to your SAT score. It's going to be part of the package. For example, if you get a 900 on your SAT, it's not like you're going to get up to 100 points and then your 900 becomes a 1,000. It will be a separate part of the overall package that is given to the admissions people at the school in which your child has the most interest. So is that BS? Is this the right thing to do? Or is this just another example of left-wing control, not over of the education system, but of the testing game in the United States? 803-0930, *930, and 1-800-616-WBEN. You know, we talked earlier about multiple choice tests and how to take multiple choice tests. And I used to do this thing, David, where I would cross off the least likely answers, those answers that I knew or reasonably believed would be false, right? So bottom line is the bottom line is when you're taking a test, what you want to do when in doubt between two answers, I think at this point in our country's devolution, you always want to pick the answer that is most favorable to the left. In other words, if it's multiple choice,
true.
Take the answer that makes the left look the best, and I don't think you can go wrong.
No, I tell my son that every day in school. I'm like, look, there's going to be things that you're going to hear that either the textbook is going to be slanted, your professor is going to put what out, whatever. You regurgitate whatever that professor wants. Your job is to get the grade. And this is a wonderful lesson in life because there are times when you have to choose between standing up for your beliefs and complying with the system because it doesn't interfere with your core principles. You want an A in the class. Will it make you feel better to stand up and say, Howard Zinn was full of garbage. There's no historical reference to what he's saying actually happened. And you end up failing the class. Or do you pick and choose your battles, decide what hill you want to die on, and if your end result is about getting a grade and moving beyond the nonsense, that's what adults do. That's what evolution's all about.
You know, I said that. People called me a coward. I said the exact same thing, and everybody was calling in saying, oh, no, that's not a good lesson to teach your kids. That's not a good way to live your life. You got to stand up, and you got to fight for your right to party. And I say balderdash to that because, well, just like you just said, your goal as a college student or your kid's goal as a college student is to get a piece of paper at the end that says you're a graduate, hopefully cum laude, magna cum laude, summa cum laude, you know, with some degree of distinction and honor. And the best way to do that is not to engage in a absolutely unfair power situation argument with a professor who does not see the world you see.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, look, I'm not saying that you take a job at Planned Parenthood on the suction device if you're pro-life. That's not what you do. But if it's a grade in a school and you don't feel that you are compromising, your core beliefs by saying, look, this professor wants me to tell him that, this is the reason why we lost the South lost the Civil War, the North won the Civil War. This is why we lost Vietnam. You tell them whatever they have in their curriculum, you get the score you want, and you learn from that. Look, there are people that believe the war in Vietnam was lost on the battlefield. That's historically without any relevance whatsoever to what actually happened, right? We lost the political will to fight, but we didn't lose any battle on the field in Vietnam. The Tet Offensive was not a military defeat.
It was a win.
It's absurd. It's ridiculous. There's no historic reference. There's nothing that matches what actually happened, but that's what the professor wants. Give him what he wants. Take your grade and say goodbye. You'll still be here in 2 years. I'm going to go get a job.
Bowerly and Bellavia, News Radio 930 WBEN. We're going to get back to something we talked about a little bit yesterday toward the end of the show. But before we do that, a lot of talk, obviously, about what's going on with our military and Iran. And, David, the drone footage, remember Jihadi John? Jihadi John was a guy who was drone hit by our government.
That, I'm telling you, you got this channel. It's Channel 4, not WIVB, but the British BBC Channel 4 out there in England. They did a documentary on Jihadi John. Jihadi John was a disgruntled rapper in London, and he did music, and it was horrible. And he would run around, and, he was just like a cool dude. And then that didn't work out. So he did what most, failed rappers do. He joined ISIS. And he went to some really bad sections. And he was the guy with the British accent that was literally beheading people with, knives. Disgusting human being. They took him out. The American Air Force took him out. And maybe, friends locally took him out, to be honest with you. But the cool part about this drone strike, if it's possible that there could be a cool part about this drone strike, is that the CIA, the image of him, they measured the angle of his beard. And the angle of his beard was enough to give them certainty that this was the guy they were looking for. And I understand you only saw him, with the pictures of when he was a rapper and, of course, when his face was covered as Jihadi John. And it is just, that's American frontier justice right there. Maybe a little overkill with the 2,500-pound bomb on his head, but, whatever you're going to do, you got to do. But
didn't he say something right before he got hit by the drone?
Do we know? No, I don't think, you don't get any audio. We don't know. But what you do is you see he's out for a walk, and he knows something's about to happen, and it goes down. But I'm just impressed that the CIA can isolate. And another thing is that al-Baghdadi just gave another speech. He was the guy that we thought he's been killed like 17 times, but he keeps coming back to life. The CIA isolated three locations of 17 possibilities where this guy was based on the architecture and the watermarks that were on the building that he was in. I mean, these guys are just, it's really incredible. There's some really brilliant minds working, on behalf of America.
America.
It's pretty damn impressive. Remember, Osama bin Laden, when he was doing his videos, he would hang out next to like a rock ledge, and they had geologists coming in. and saying, yeah, we think he's in this part of Pakistan. We think he's in this part of the Hindu Kush because of this is the type of rock and this is the type of like. So if you notice, most of those terrorists started doing their videos like in front of carpets. And even those carpets were like, that carpet was purchased in Baghdad. And that's the type of Persian rug that's made in Tehran. And it's like, you can't win. You can't win. And God bless those.
How about a plain white bedsheet?
Well, yeah, again, they'll find out it's from the guy from MyPillow. You know, that section of Egypt that makes the...
Boll & Branch.
Boll & Branch sheets. Bombed a Boll & Branch manufacturing plant.
My goodness.
It. No, it, seriously, though, there's so many smart people out there keeping us safe, and it just shows, you know, when they're not spying on presidential candidates, they're doing good stuff.
Now, these are the intelligence analysts who do this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many. I mean, everyone thinks that today's, you know, we've got folks right here in Niagara Falls that, you know, are the tip of the spear of the war on terror. You know, everyone thinks, well, you know, the Air Force, what is the Air Force? Unless you're a pilot, you're in the fight. Those drones are operated remote. But those analysts that work with these, you know, soldiers and sailors and Marines and you name it, airmen and women, it's really incredible the amount of just what you're learning at 22 years of age and the power and the technology and the money that's invested in you. First of all, they got to be perfect every single time. And when they make mistakes, you know, it's not fun, but they make very few mistakes. They're some of the most professional. And I just think back to like when I was a private in the Army, like there's no way in hell they would give me a $25 million missile. You know what I mean? And these guys are working with machinery and gear that's just, you know, in the billions of dollars. It's really impressive.
So if he was hit with a 2,500-pound projectile, he's definitely dead, right?
Well, I think he's missed. I think he's missed. Again, those depending on what they tomahawked him or 500-pound, 25, whatever the joint direct ammunition, whatever the ordnance was, it was devastating. And this is a horrible guy. I mean, it's, I remember when Zarqawi was hit, there was, you know, basically the building pancaked on him. And you never know. And that was one of the reasons why the Obama administration wanted to take bin Laden out, because with the JDAM, you never know. I mean, you don't want to overkill it if you're at the wrong target and there's civilians in there. And there would have been a horrible issue because there were so many kids and women in that compound.
You know, speaking about matters military, I think I'd be very, very remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about what's going on right now vis-a-vis the United States and Iran. Since we last spoke about it, has there been any movement or any indication that any kind of an attack or any kind of fight is imminent or could be a distinct possibility?
Yeah, we got an update today that Iran's Revolutionary Guard are basically coordinating with the militias in Iraq to attack American targets. This is something that was expected. They're asking for a proxy war. The Iranian influence, I mean, look, it wasn't just ISIS that took over Iraq. The Iranians were in there, you know, right as the insurgency kicked off. They were sponsoring it, training, providing munitions. Those 5,000 Americans are now at a defense condition that's the highest it can be. And you got to worry about, you know, blue versus green, where you've got, you know, troops that you're working with in Iraqi uniforms that are not on your side. It's a very stressful situation, but those men and women are trained, they're prepared, they're at a very heightened defense condition, and they'll be ready for whatever they have. But I mean, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard basically said, you know, militias, Sadr, all those boys out there, the Mahdi's, in Karbala, in Najaf, in sections of Sadr City, you know, it's time to fight again. And whether or not the Iraqis are able to do that and keep those people isolated, pacify those guys, we'll find out. But the Easter uprising, the Shia uprising in 2004 was a really tough one.
Now, the Iranians, their government seems to be relatively quiet regarding all of the American, I don't want to say incursions, but the American force being sent their way.
Well, look, you got to understand, the world, the American media and the Western, you know, European allies, they see Donald Trump as, you know, what the media calls Donald Trump. He's unhinged. He's crazy. He's not presidential. You can't predict what he's going to text from one minute to the next on Twitter.
He's Dave Semenko.
But the rest of the world sees that, and that is not something they're comfortable with. They don't know how to predict this president, this commander-in-chief. They don't know if is this guy going to go all the way. George W. Bush got very predictable towards the end of his administration. You know, when Putin just walked into Georgia, not the state, of course, but the country, and threw the Georgian army around. I remember watching that in Iraq. I was out there not as a soldier, but a civilian, and I was watching the video of the, you know, Putin's Russia just decimating the Georgian army. And these guys were risking their lives in Iraq with Americans saying, like, why aren't you doing anything about this? It was very awkward. It was very uncomfortable. They had risked a lot of lives in Iraq with American forces, and we just allowed Putin to do whatever the hell he wanted in Georgia. The Iranians obviously weren't threatened by the Obama administration during the Green Uprising. That was a perfect opportunity to overthrow the mullahs. They didn't do a thing about it. This president cannot be predicted. They have no idea what he's going to do. Obviously, Kim Jong-un thought he was going to take him out. So I think that, although it doesn't play for the best confidence when it comes to stateside and the media, it really, really works when it comes to foreign policy, because nobody has any idea, unfortunately, including NATO. You know, he does not play his cards, and he doesn't tell anyone what he's going to do. Everything's on the table. And I think that's the way it should be. I don't think you're supposed to telegraph when you're going to attack, if you're going to attack. You basically look at your adversary and say, hey, choose your own adventure.
Yeah, well, you don't want to have a tell. You know, should we be concerned at all, David, that, you know, you mentioned Kim Jong-un, and that was like my next question as far as North Korea. Obviously, North Korea at one point was acting in a very bellicose way. They were testing missiles every other week. Air raid sirens were going off at various places in the Pacific. So the United States got serious and sent a whole bunch of our military people to the area off of North Korea. We've had two summits now, no deal with North Korea. And once again, North Korea seems to be acting with a degree of bellicosity. Should we be concerned that we're willing to, like, walk up to the brink but not actually pull the trigger, and then we're going to be outweighed for as long as Donald Trump is president? The North Koreans and the Iranians will behave themselves, but the minute Donald Trump is out of office, if they think they've got another patsy in there.
I think that's a valid point. I think everyone thinks about, you know, when there's a change of administrations, how they look at it. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, until a C-130 flies into Tehran and drops off, you know, 14, you know, pallets of hard currency, you know, the way that Iran was treated before by the Obama administration was just ridiculous. I mean, you would think they were a most favored nation, the amount of respect and courtesies they were given, bribe money they were given. Kim Jong-un has a finite amount of material to test. The testing that he was doing recently was the equivalent of, you know, shooting a TOW missile into the Rocky Mountains. I mean, that what was happening before is he was launching projectiles without guidance systems over civilian areas of Japan. And anything can happen there. It could fall and land on a civilian target. It could hit a military. It could have hit a vessel outside of the peninsula. And Americans could have been in harm's way. That's absolutely reckless and unacceptable. You're not going to see testing like that. You're certainly not going to see underground testing because, quite frankly, I don't think they have enough material. I think the world believes that they don't have enough material to do that. And the other side is that, you know, what does Russia really believe the end state is? I mean, China and Russia have a tremendous amount of sway when it comes to what North Korea wants to do. And, you know, again, whether or not Kim Jong-un ever gives up his, you know, technology and his stuff, the key is, does he have enough to create something and use it? We're confident that he's, you know, desperate enough to do whatever he can to get his way. But the key is to not allow him the material that he could create something and launch it on his neighbors. But do the American people want a war in North Korea? Absolutely not. Do the people in the region want a war? No. But does anyone think that Donald Trump wouldn't preemptively strike North Korea? Obviously they do, because anytime he moves his Navy around, China backs down, Russia backs down, North Korea backs down, and now you're going to see Iran backing down.
When Iran backs down, if Iran backs down, well, I'll tell you, we're going to have to revisit this here in a moment on News Radio 930 WBEN. So if push comes to shove with Iran, David, knowing what you know about the people of Iran, what are the chances that we can finally get rid of these a-holes, the mullahs and the ayatollahs?
If you look at all of the prognostications that turned out to be almost 180 degrees from the reality on the ground in Iraq, the reality was that people misunderstood the tribal nature of Iraq. And the worst thing you can do when you're introducing democracy to any nation is to give them a European parliament. I mean, that most Americans don't know how England works. It's a very confusing political structure. They did not have a strong judiciary. You then had, of course, the decision to get rid of the Ba'athist party and the Sunnis that were in charge of different things. But there was the, a bunch of guys sitting around in, hotels on K Street decided that Iraq has a middle class. And that if you take out Saddam, that vacuum is going to be filled and the middle class is going to step up and say, we're ready to take over the reins. One thing we know about Iran is that they do have a middle class. There are people that are listening to American music and drinking Pepsi and drinking Budweiser and smoking cigarettes, and that all of the rules that the Ayatollah has, there is a group of students out there that do want to fight for their freedom, and there is a class of people ready to take that over. You didn't have that in Iraq, and it was completely misdiagnosed. And the other thing was that people underestimated Saddam's ability there was almost a pan-Arabism in even though Iraq is predominantly Shia. He got Sunnis and Shia in fear, whatever the reasons were. They fought together. And they had there was a pride of nationalism in Iraq. And again, these guys got all this information wrong. What we do know is that Iran has an independence to them. Iranians do have a middle class. There are young people that are willing to sacrifice. And more importantly, there are a lot of foreign Iranians that would come in and eagerly take out the Ayatollahs, the mullahs and the Ayatollah. The fact is that as crazy as Saddam was, as ruthless and as bloody as Saddam was, there was a moderate, his Islam was not radical. He, there was alcohol. There was the ability to, have weapons in Iraq in your home and self-defense. And those things don't happen over there. And so the people are ready, and they've been ready for years. It's just, do they trust the West to actually back them up? And that's something I don't think the West is ready for. I don't think the people of the UK want it. I don't think NATO wants it. I don't think the American people want another war. And so I think this is more political than it is military. But in a heartbeat, if we turn the switch, those guys are out of power.
Well, yeah, we can certainly hope that the people of Iran would rise up. I mean, we hope, obviously, for a minimum of bloodshed, especially American bloodshed, but hopefully we'll be able to change the course of history by getting the mullahs and the ayatollahs from their place of power in Iran, a place of power they've occupied since the late 1970s and the Iran hostage crisis, which was the beginning of Ted Koppel's career on Nightline.
And understand, like Iraq, they are choking on these sanctions now. The sanctions are back in and the economy is crumbling, and that's another pro for the destabilizing the regime.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.